Welcome back. You're still tuned in to Ubuntu Radio, South Africa's public diplomacy in action. If you are joining us online and load shedding happens to visit you, hopefully you have some backup. You can be able to switch on your DSTV and dial in 3-pull-8, that is 888. You'll be able to continue this conversation with us. Is the studio line working? Maybe if you can, you have your phone, you can try that and see if we can get you in and to talk with us. That is 012329-2239. If you're outside the borders of South Africa, use the +27 123292239, and you'll be able to have a conversation with us on the social media platforms. Do tag Ubuntu Radio ZA, hashtag the midday conversation. We'd be happy to talk to you. I think it's always good to not have a monologue. Talk to who's the person who's on the other side, you know.
100%.
So yeah, it would be great to talk. I mean, today we have a very interesting conversation with Ayanda, who just joined us in the studio. So you don't want to miss that one. You definitely have to, if you want to engage, if you like your politics, if you love your country, if you love your community, you have to listen to this one. Makubo, what do we talk about? Ayanda is here, looking good and beautiful with us. Hi, Ayanda. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, gentlemen. How are you? You're welcome.
Oh, we're good.
Oh, yeah, well.
Good.
Yeah, well.
Good. I was a bit worried, though. For some time, SABC 2, no voice. Power FM,
no
voice. 702, where's Ayanda? Then recently, President delivers Sona. boom. I'm like, what? My goodness, did she go to some political training or what?
She was cooking underground. Ayanda's been there from broadcasting. I went into community development. I went back home in Dobsonville, Soweto. We started a youth organization called Bukobami Youth Center.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Turning 9 years old this June. So we've been at it for a bit. I went back to school, did my master's in public administration.
Oh,
thank you. Went into government as well. Had a short stint as the spokesperson for the Ministry of Transport. And then I continued to produce and present some TV shows that would play just on community development, active citizenry. Wrote a book also about just how to empower ourselves as a people and play our part. Wrote an album and sang some songs also about about how we empower ourselves as individuals, how to change status quo, how to be the solutions to some of our societal ills. So I've been working, I've been learning, I've been growing, I've been trying to increase my capacity, and then I stumbled on my new position that looks like was intentional, but I think it was serendipitous. It was just one of those things where all the history, all the past, all the experience, all the expertise that I managed to gather culminated in that very point in time and the response to the Sona.
Wow, you are multi-talented. Mm. I'm glad to have, young people like you who are, you know, doing these things, community work, improving yourself. You go to the music space, you write books, and now you do politics, something that most of us have been afraid to do. Mm. You think politics is like, parliament in Yolala. You know, so we're so happy to have you, and we're so happy
Thank
to
you
see
so
you
much.
That you're doing amazing things.
Thank
out there.
You so much. In fact, I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who was also saying, and then ipolitiki ingena kuphi. And I said to this friend, you know, there was a beautiful phrase that was coined by the women's suffrage movement. I think it was in the US when women were trying to fight for their rights to vote, and they coined that phrase, the political is personal, or the personal is political, which means you can't divorce your daily experience and your daily realities from the political space. It will affect you in one way or another.
Yeah.
And so at some point you realize that where I live is affected by the politics of the day and age, you know, where I work, if I work, you know, the kind of foods I can afford, where my children go to school, etc., is all a manifestation of the political climate within which we exist. And at some point you then realize that I can try and fix the symptoms on the ground, or the symptoms where I am able to reach, or I can try and say, let's go to the source of the problem. Let's go to the politics of it all and try and change the systems and status quo from there. Then the ripple effect will be felt in the way that I live, or where I stay, or where my kids go to school, etc. So you reach a point in time when you're like, you know what, I'm actually tired just dealing with the fruits. I want want to deal with the roots of the problem. So that's all. That's, I think that's how I found myself in politics.
That's beautiful. That's great. And you guys are listening, right?
Yep,
we're all joining one or two political parties. It affects us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. What are we talking about, Makubo, if now that we have Ayanda with us in the studio?
No, 100%, Mr. Maupo has correctly communicated that Ms. Ali is here with us in the studio, but she's wearing her communications director hat today for BOSA, Build One SA. Of course, you know Build One SA is a South African political party formed in 2022, and it's led by veteran opposition leader Mr. Musi Maimane. In January 2020, get this, Mr. Maupa, Mr. Maimane actually founded One South Africa, a civic organization to promote political engagements and support independent candidates in 2021 election.
Mm.
It was this organization from which Build One SA, BOSA, evolved. BOSA was launched on South African Heritage Day, September 24, in 2022, and BOSA positions itself as an alternative to mainstream political parties. Mm. The organization espoused a commitment to African philosophy of Ubuntu on Ubuntu Radio and identified 9 key values the party held in support of that notion, which is dignity, unity, collaboration, community, integrity, active citizenship, accountability, equality, and inclusiveness, and servant and ethical leadership. We, of course, have Ms. Ayanda Ali, the communications director.
That may sound quite mouthful, but we're going to break it down, 100%. Right? We're going to try and then break it down for you in case you got confused or you lost the track of what Makubo said there. We're going to break it down for you. We have all the time that you need. Is it BOSA or BOSA? Sabelo and I pronounce it differently.
I love it. And so many people do pronounce it differently as well. It's BOSA officially, B-O-S-A.
Yeah.
But because BOSA ya BOSA, we are not offended when people say BOSA as well. We're like, of course, it's ya BOSA and ra BOSA. So definitely. So it depends on how you prefer to mention it. Just as long as you mention it and you vote for it. That's what matters to us.
That's
what's in the name?
That's the voice of Ayanda, Miss Ayanda Ali, joining us live in the studio, talking about BOSA or BOSA, whichever way you prefer. Mm. This is the Midday Conversation on Ubuntu Radio. We'll be back after this.
From Khayelitsha to Musina, our money crisscrosses the country, connecting communities. Now our banknotes and coin look a little different, with upgraded security features and new designs celebrating our heritage. But don't worry, your trusted rands with the new designs and the older ones are still worth the same. So go on, use both with confidence. Our money, our pride. SA Reserve Bank, connecting us.
This is The Agenda on Ubuntu Radio with Dali Munjedi.
Can we imagine a world without the United Nations?
It will be difficult to have a world without the United Nations. Now more than ever, diplomacy is needed. Multilateralism is needed. The world is facing so many challenges, some of them that bears common and shared responsibility. Coming together in an objective platform that is also devoid of any attachment to a particular member state. So makes the United Nations very, very significant.
The Agenda on Ubuntu Radio, Monday to Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. Central African Time.
Yep, I'm glad you are still with us. You didn't touch that dial. Of course, we are in conversation with Ayanda Ali, Ms. Ayanda Ali, representing Build One South Africa, that is BOSA or BOSA, whichever way you prefer. And we're going to delve into conversation, and this is what we're going to do, Ayanda. We're going to divide this into three sort of segments. One, I would like us to talk about the politics of BOSA. I'd like us to talk about the socio-economic plans of BOSA leading to the election or leading to you being a government. And lastly, I'd like us to talk about governance. And we do this with an aim of you painting a picture on why should an individual consider or think about voting BOSA come the 29th of May. Will that be fine?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Great stuff. Now, let's start, Makubo, on the, you know, the big part. You go to BOSA's website, and they say about us, the first thing you get the mission. And the mission reads something along that you are a more representative, equitable and prosperous nations for all, right? And in my mind, representativeness or equitable or prosperous could it's very highly contested if you look how the politicians will go around and talking about these terms. Some even dismiss the idea that they are interconnected. Some, you know, will push depending on the, whether you're on the right or left of the side of the politics. For Busa or Bosa, what constitute, if you paint a picture for us, how does a prosperous nation look like in South Africa?
You know, Udadu Nelson Mandela said, and I quote, he said, "I've fought against black domination. I have fought against white domination. I've cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity."
Mm.
Close quote. We as Bosa believe that a prosperous South Africa is one where people are able to self-actualize. Where people feel safe in their homes, where they have food on the table, they have clothes on their backs, a roof over their heads, they can take their children to schools, and the schools will teach the children good quality education that will help them to not only grow up to be employable, but to also grow up to be employers.
Mm.
We believe that this prosperous South Africa is one where a woman does not have to be watching what she's wearing or what time she's stepping out of the house to run or to jog. Mm. It's where a woman can feel safe within the confines of her own home or even stepping out in a social or public space without fear of being abused in any way. It is a South Africa where you're able to drive at any time of day and night, and you as an independent individual will not feel as if you will be hijacked or have your property stolen in any way, shape or form. It is a South Africa where, you know, and the head of state mentions this often, where the civil service is competent and is able to provide services for the betterment of others. We hear the rhetoric often enough, but seldom do we see it at play. So when we say it's a South Africa with a competent public sector, it means there's no line that curls right until the end of the building when you're waiting at a Home Affairs Department, as is the case as we speak in Roodepoort.
Yeah.
It means it is not a sector where if I go to a public hospital, I must wonder whether or not they've got the correct medication, let alone the correct number of doctors that are there. So we envisage a South Africa where people will be able to live good quality lives, will be able to achieve as much as their own desires are able to take them. And it is one that has social cohesion, where we see each other as friends as opposed to foes. And we're able to work together because we're of the view that there is more that unites us than that which divides. So this is the South Africa that we envisage.
Who's the all? You speak about the all. And ANC came into power in 1994. They said something, their manifesto had it all, you know, freedom for all. 8 years down the line, there's no freedom for all. Again, who's the all? I mean, now you have currently people who are better off, prosperous, and some are not. How do you balance this, and who's this all that you refer to?
I think the all means exactly that for us. Absolutely everybody should be included in the prosperity of this nation. All of us should benefit from the fruits of this beautiful country that we live in. I'm going to dissect a little bit by what we mean by all, because I can see you're looking for more granular details and more specifics.
Sure.
We live in a country where politics is very much divisive, right? It's about me fighting for a particular kind of people in terms of demographics, their race, their age, etc., and we're fighting against this kind of people that we now have labeled as the boogeyman or the enemy, etc. But we're of the view that absolutely everybody in South Africa is feeling the pinch in one way or another. Whether you are living in Dutywa, whether you are living in Dobsonville, in Mdantsane, or you're living in Sandton, whether you are middle class, as some of us may categorize ourselves, there is an area where you are feeling the pinch. Middle class South Africans will tell you that we are struggling to put food you know, on the table many, many a times. Yeah. That's because we're heavily indebted. We are often a month away from poverty, if we're being honest. Yeah. Take away the salary of that month and it's tickets for all of us. And it's not just for the immediate family, but for all of those who are dependent on you. Some call it black tax. I call it a responsibility that you have to those around you. But we are all feeling the pinch. Then you go down and you go to your grassroots levels, perhaps in the rural areas, in the townships, and you will know that there too, people are overwhelmed by the societal ills, by poverty, unemployment, inequality. They are overwhelmed by drug abuse and all manner of social ills that are there as well. You take it right up to the upper echelons of society where the 1% are living over there. They also know that in order for them to do any business with the state, for example, there must be brown envelopes that are taken out. Yeah. They know that their investments as well could be plundered, as we saw in the uprisings in June, July, several years ago, where in just an instant people can cause an uproar and go into your stores and ransack, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's this uneasiness that we all feel as a nation.
Yeah.
And we need a political party like Build One South Africa that is saying, we have all your best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. We can achieve unity that is equity driven. And I always have to qualify it, because mm-hmm. people think we're saying unity, forget everything, forget the past. There's no need for us to bring about equality. Let's just move forward. We're saying we can work together because it is in all of our best interests that we right the wrongs of the past. It is in all of our best interests that we empower the disempowered. It is in all of our interests that we work towards a government that is not corrupt, so as to free up enough assets for us to build this beautiful nation of ours, for us to maintain the infrastructure, for us to build on those mega projects and grow our economy even more. So if we then have leadership that everybody can believe in, can buy into, both business and communities, and people are free to give their taxes because they know it's going to be used properly, and business is able to also give their taxes instead of trying to taking it overseas, because they know that this country is going to use their assets wisely. If we can have one party like Build One South Africa that is able to join all of us behind one common vision and purpose, there is enough of this new bigger pie that we speak of for everybody to be able to be satisfied, for people in Dobsonville to be able to have a good quality life, where your child can go to school even within a 5 kilometer radius of where you stay and have the same kind of education as a child who's living in Sandton, where someone who is living in Florida, where someone once called it the diaspora of the township. If you're living in your Roodepoort like me, where I'm living in the diaspora of the township, I can also have a decent, dignified life. And wherever we are in this nation, we can make sure that the way in which we work, the way in which we live, can be one that gives people a sense of purpose and dignity, regardless of where you are in terms of life standing and the LSM. Hmm.
Yeah, and I think you speak of leadership, you know, carrying that wonderful vision that you've just outlined for us. And I think we can't escape that in this country, of course, you know, party politics are largely contributed by whoever is leading the party, you know. And in this instance, we've got Mr. Musi Maimane, who started the party, of course, you know, after one essay and so forth.
Yeah.
So how do voters get the assurance that Mr. Maimane is not coming with DA politics? Because, I mean, of course, it's a question that will come.
Yeah.
He spent a large part of his life in the Democratic Alliance, you know, and a lot of people obviously know him and identify him with that.
Absolutely.
If you search for his name, that's the first thing, one of the first things that come up. So how do voters get the assurance that, you know, there's a distinct difference between Bosa and the politics of Bosa and the politics of the DA?
I think I'm going to answer that question twofold. Firstly, I don't think it's a bad thing that he has experience in party politics. It's also very little known that he was also in the ANC, and when he started out and had this really fervent passion for nation building, he did start out in the ANC. Politics there did not resonate with where he saw South Africa going. He went to the Democratic Alliance, and I think that's a good thing, because we are the sum total of our experiences.
Yes.
So he brings with him an understanding of how party politics work, what needs to be improved upon, what needs to be completely eradicated, complicated, what needs to be explored a little bit more. And I think it makes him the kind of leader that he is, because hindsight is 20/20 vision. Mm-hmm. It makes him sharper. It makes him more astute. It makes him have that much more gravitas in this space.
Yeah.
He's not coming in as someone who's naive, who is a novice, who's, you know, going to try out and experiment things. He's coming in as somebody who has a full understanding and capacity of what it takes to lead, and what it takes to lead from the bottom up, which is why when they started, and I wasn't there, when they started One South Africa, the first thing they did was to go to grassroots level to say, we want to work with active citizens who are already on the ground, already giving of themselves and their time, and then there to start a movement that is bottom up. That's my first response. The second one, and you're quite right, some people will come and say, oh, but Musi and DA, etc. But it's interesting to me, because the same is not said necessarily about Julius Malema and the ANC. And to equate the contribution of Musi Maimane to just, you know, someone who is from the DA, I think misses the point somewhat, because it's important to see the distinction between the two. When he realized that the direction and the trajectory of the Democratic Alliance is no longer in line with where he believes South Africa ought to go, that's when he stepped aside and decided, I'm going to find a better way and a better path. The Democratic Alliance seeks to nullify the impact and the effects of the apartheid government. They seek to put themselves on the right, where they're saying there's no need for you know, restitution, there's no need for BEE, there's no need for us to try and bring about an equitable, you know, life for all. Let's just move on. Let's just forget the past. And what we're saying is, Build One South Africa, is we need to take all of that into consideration, but we need to make sure that the government is not perpetuating that, as is the case right now. Because right now we have a government where 30 years down the line, we're still seeing that your lower quintile schools, quintile 1, 2, and 3, are still in the township and rural area, you know, where the ones that are better are still in suburbia. So we're saying the only way that we can really fix the errors of the past is to make sure that we've got competent people in place, competent people who are running SOEs and other government organs of state. And when we do that, we can then be able to really empower those who were previously disempowered and make sure that they participate actively and meaningfully in the economy. Then we move forward. That's the clear distinction between us and the Democratic Alliance.
And I think obviously focusing on the clear distinction between you and the Democratic Alliance, you know, part and parcel of what comes with a new, forming a new party is forming new leadership, you know. Of course, Mr. Maimane has to inspire people such as yourself to join him in this new espoused vision and to follow him in this vision. What is Bosa's way of recruiting leadership? We know of other political parties, and we know of, you know, how they do the recruitment, you know, but what is Bosa's step-by-step recruitment of leadership? So if I know that I'm voting for, you know, Bosa or Busa, and part and parcel is this leadership, how did they get there?
I love it. I think it's one of the most it's one of the most groundbreaking things that have happened in South African politics. It is a first, by the way. It was spearheaded and championed by Bosa. It has since been replicated by other political parties, and we think that is actually quite a good thing. The more the merrier. But what has happened is we are seeing people who have already proven themselves as leaders in their different spheres of influence. So others are in community building, others are in health, others are in the legal fraternity, others are in education, others are in the corporate sector. And these are people who are tried, tested, and true, who then get elected and voted by their communities. So somebody says, I like Ayanda, I saw the work she did at Bukobami, I've been watching her in the media and communication space, I really think she represents my interests as a woman, as a man, as a young person, old person, and I would like to see her represent me in parliament. And to have that as a way in which we elect leaders minimizes things of, no, I understand, because she's somebody's comrade or somebody's friend, or she's there because her surname carries a legacy in terms of the struggle. I understand, based on the work that she's already done, and the people who support her have proven that they believe in her leadership. But should Ayanda, for whatever reason, fail to live up to what people want her to do, they are able to recall her and say, she no longer represents our interests. We sent her to parliament. We don't know what she's doing there now. She's busy with weaves, or she's sleeping. She's just loving the Cape Town life, and she's no longer fulfilling the promises that she said she would fulfill. They are then able to, through the same process, say, may we recall this person because she's no longer serving the purpose. And that is the fundamental importance of making sure that you have leaders who have a good moral upstanding, leaders who are ethical, leaders who are able to be competent. We espouse education, making sure you are fit for purpose, to the point where we're saying, if you go on and you make it to parliament but you don't have the requisite qualifications, you have to, by the time that this this current government that will be elected has concluded, you have to have received that qualification. So serious are we that we want to make sure that those who are not skilled in a particular area, you must be skilled. Go to financial services for beginners if you need to. You're not going to be in a parliament portfolio committee without having an idea of what happens in that committee. How are you going to hold people accountable if you are in a portfolio committee for transport but you have no idea what's going on in that sector? So for us, the way in which we elect our leadership, firstly making sure that you have that endorsement, 1,000 signatures from those community members that you appeal to, making sure that you are interviewed by a panel of experts who say, here's what we're looking for, are you competent here, what do you need to work on, having those key deliverables, what you need to achieve as a candidate that's there, and being held to account. I think it's groundbreaking, it's revolutionary, and it's something that we should be doing. I think by and large, we can't wait to be in charge of some SOEs and some municipalities as well in the next elections, where we'll be able to put competent people in positions.
So you've redefined the way politics is done. So for you, things of conferences and that doesn't apply to you.
I think conferences, in paper, on black and white, they do seem like something that is quite democratic. You know, you get numbers and people vote for you and then you're in this position. But we know that it's susceptible to corruption because people who get voted there can sometimes buy the votes. It's about your friends, your clubs, you know, this one is on this slate, this one is on that slate. It's no longer really about, can this person do the job? That's why you're able to find people who've been found guilty of abusing women or smacking women, but they are there. They've been chosen in conference. Or people who have been found to be questionable in a commission of inquiry, or people who've been found to have lied under oath, or people who have been found to be incapable of running any government department, but they're there on the list because they're friends of so and so. This comrade, they're good standing, etc. etc. That's wrong, because you are now going to give us the same leaders with question marks on their over their heads, the same leaders who in the community people look at them and say, we got deal in the community, aguna sket angadlulanga kuso lana in this community, but they are a leader representing us in parliament. That should not be the case. Just because the party has deemed you to be a member in good standing and someone who's eloquent in any particular matter, so we are going to put you there. We're saying the community must be the one. The community must say, this person we vouch for, this person has a proven track record, she or he has given of themselves, of their time, has sacrificed of their very personhood in order to pursue whatever initiative she had done prior to politics. This person deserves to represent us in parliament, not because you are in some party list or you are chosen in conference, regardless of, I mean, it's, you look at the caliber of leaders that we have, we even laugh because we give them nicknames. Cupcake. Tiger. But what I'm basically saying is that we have to be able to choose our leaders based on the work that they've done in the community, and they must be chosen directly by the community members because of their efficacy on the ground.
Yeah, and I think very well, you know, very well done. I was looking at the model itself, and it's quite a unique one. It's quite a different one. But by the same vein, you know, if I can find 1,000 people, no matter what my where my integrity levels are, you know, where my morals levels are, if I can find 1,000 people, in essence, you know, I can sort of slip through the system. So how do you defend that?
I love that. So there are different phases to this thing. So I don't know if it's like Idols. You make it 5 past the top 10, top 5, then there's like top 3, etc. You're quite right. The initial phase of lifting your hands up and filling in an application form, then getting the vetting form, you have to go to your either police station or some of those entities that are able to vet you. So that's what you supply. I did the same process as well. I'd like to apply as a candidate, as Ayanda. Here's my form. Here's my police clearance. And then you go to the next round. ground. Now you must get those 1,000 signatures. You go online, hi guys, please, can you be my people who endorse me, etc. People do that. And then now, and this is what I'm going to be doing next week, you go through your interview process, where people sit down and then they dissect and they go through your past and they go through your social media and they go through the person that you are, some of the decisions. And I mean, I have no doubt I'll be asked, so you went to government, you stayed there for 2 years. Why did you leave? Was there anything that was untoward there? You know, so you get looked into and scrutinized by people from different sectors who are able to say, oh, so when it comes to this, did you do business with the state? Did you, I don't know, have any police record of having been physically abusive towards so-and-so? Whatever the case may be, you're asked those kinds of questions by an independent panel of experts then outside the 1,000. Because you're right, I could be just very popular and people are like, ah, this one is yellow. She talks a lot. Let's give her 1,000 votes. And only to find that this person is not credible. So it's important that we have that next layer then of the interviews that sifts through whether or not you can move to the next round.
And that leads me to my question, Ayanda. You have, I think, in your party, people like previous Mayor Stevens Makgalapa. Did he also undergo the same process, given the history that is surrounding him, and how did he, was he an exception to the party?
So my understanding, and of course this was prior to my arrival there, he is now in the board. He's not one of the candidates as we speak, although he will be, if running for candidacy, will be facing the exact same scrutiny, exact same questions, and will be weighed and measured like the rest of us, and will be asked those difficult questions. You're quite right about his experience, especially being someone who's from Tshwane. You will know the history that's there as well. But my understanding is that if he is running as a candidate, he will be facing those same questions, just as I will be asked some questions about my own background, about my own history as well.
All right. That's very interesting. Look, this is a call to someone or anyone in the community, right, that says, I'm ready to serve. And you've heard the process. It's quite a stringent, strict process. Obviously, I mean, we are human beings, maybe a mistake there and there, but there is a home called Busa that will be able to take you without you having to know a Comrade X campaign, throw in envelopes, and the process is there. So I think that's quite interesting. It redefines how we think about politics. It redefines how we think about leadership in politics, and looking forward to see how it matures over time and how many people will be adopting that particular approach. Now, you are campaigning for a number of changes, including the legislative reforms. You are saying there must be an independent Speaker of Parliament. You are saying go away with the deputy ministers. We don't need them. Why is that?
We want a leaner, meaner government machine. The public purse is bloated. And that is because there are way too many ministries, way too many ministers, way too many deputy ministers. And remember, the cost factor that is there. With every minister, there's a ministerial office. There's an Ayanda, there was a spokesperson. There's an advisor there. There's drivers. Yeah. There's homes. There's bodyguard, security personnel, etc. Per minister. For a deputy minister, the exact same system then also exists. And what is surprising is the deputy minister, when a minister is not able to fulfill the duty, the deputy minister does not have the power to step in. So therefore, you ask yourself, what is the role of a deputy minister? In the unfortunate cases where we've seen ministers pass on while they are still in office, we've seen that there be another minister who's then now able to assist in that role for the time being until a more permanent minister is replaced. The deputy minister is there but cannot step up to the plate. So that is a layer of fat that we need to trim as a country that is in dire financial situations, that we need to be able to pay back some of our debt. And these are easy ways that we can deal with it. We want smaller numbers of ministries or departments that are there, but more impact. And how you do that is you get people who are competent per ministry or per department. Because if you've got advisors, a dime a dozen, you put Ayanda, I mean, God forbid, I have got no understanding of engineering. Don't make me minister of of anything that is related to that. So, because that means I must now get more advisors, etc., etc., that you pay extra for them to advise me. Put put me anywhere that's related to communication. Put me anywhere that's related to social development.
Yeah.
Put me right there and I will flourish. I do not need an extra entourage of people to do that. So we're saying make sure that the people who are there are competent and make sure that there are smaller numbers of those ministries that are there. And we're doing away, of course, with your deputy ministers.
Sure. We are speaking to the comms manager, director of BOSA, Build One SA, talking all things elections, talking all things their politics, their strategies. We're not holding any punches back. If you want to ask, please do so. Social media platforms, we here to say, why should we vote for them? And they're giving us all the information that we need right now. But let's cross over, pay our bills. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ayanda Ali in the studio with us.
This is The Agenda on Ubuntu Radio with Dali Munjezi.
Can we imagine a world without the United Nations?
It will be difficult to have a world without the United Nations. Now more than ever, diplomacy is needed. Multilateralism is needed. The world is facing so many challenges, some of them that bears common and shared responsibility. Coming together in an objective platform that is also devoid of any attachment to a particular member state. So makes the United Nations very, very significant.
The Agenda on Ubuntu Radio, Monday to Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. Central African Time.
Are you planning to travel outside South Africa soon on business or for leisure? Before your departure, visit the Department of International Relations and Cooperation's website, www.dirco.gov.za. Click the links Foreign Relations, South African Representatives Abroad to ensure that you have the contact details of the South African Embassy, High Commission or Consulate in the country which you will be visiting.
This message was brought to you by Ubuntu Radio in partnership with Durco Consular Services. Ubuntu Radio, South Africa's public diplomacy in action.
Welcome back to Ubuntu Radio. You're still tuned in to the Midday Conversation here with me, Sabelo Makubo, and Vusi Maupa. We, of course, have Ms. Ayanda Ali, the comms director for BOSA or Build One SA, as you may. And we're just talking before the break about part and parcel of what makes up their political conversation, what makes up their politics. And just before we went to the break, she was just taking us through about, you know, how do you get to become an elected official of BOSA? You know, it's quite a stringent and very strict process.
Very unique, innovative.
Fresh. You know, And then, of course, she took us through why they want to trim down on the deputy ministers and so forth. But I think an interesting question I wanted to ask is, it seems BOSA is focused a lot on, you know, independency. You speak of the process that you just outlaid for us in terms of your membership or people being representatives that are vetted by an external and an independent board. You're proposing, of course, that we have an independent Speaker of Parliament. And I just want to understand why the external focus? Why would you want a lot of independency? People making decisions about, you know, who gets to get represented, and that being somebody who is independent to BOSA.
I think we have relegated a lot of our politics as a country to politicians. And that's where we've gone wrong many times.
Sure.
We have ceded our own responsibility as people to a handful of individuals who have proven to us time and time again that they are not worthy of our trust and our belief. And therefore, we have said South Africans have proven that they are able to organize.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I live in a community where we as residents club together, Sikipama 200 every month, and we have appointed someone who drives around different streets in your block watch.
Yeah.
And this person makes sure that if you need anything, we call them and we say, please, can you help house number so-and-so? They're in distress. Or I've not closed my gate. Please, can someone keep an eye, etc. We've right. displayed the ability to organize and to govern. That is a responsibility of providing safety and security for your community.
Sure.
In Dobsonville, where we live, I'm a patroller. They're there. Mm. You know, from time to time, they'll say, you know, can you help us with flashlights or reflector jackets, etc. They've organized.
Yeah.
And they do this to make sure that Losisi or Puma Endlini at 4 o'clock in the morning to go and get a taxi or a bus. And is assisted from their gate to the bus stop or the taxi rank without being robbed, without being abused in any way. That's a community providing solutions that are there. We have proven that we're able to take charge and lead when it comes to schools through the school governing bodies. And where that model works, it works brilliantly because they're even able to hire additional teachers. The SGB is able to fundraise and hire teachers where there's a deficit in the school. And so that's why we're of the view that South Africans are able to find solutions for this country that can assist the politicians better around the country. This is why we advocate for public-private partnerships as well. So we're not saying just civil society work with government. We're saying even the private sector must play its part as a responsible corporate citizen. And we're saying that we want those expertise that are able to help your conglomerates and your multinationals run efficiently. We want those skills also in the public sector.
Mm.
We want them to be able to influence the way things are done in the public sector.
Yeah.
So we want, when we say independent, we mean those who have been able to prove for what we're talking about through their own private means. They've done the trial and error, etc. We should not have to do that as the state. They have done the lessons. They can come and assist us. And where they feel that the state is delivering on its mandate, they do help in the from the private sector, just like community members and civil society groups. Where they feel that any government official is doing what they need to do, they always help. They always lend a helping hand. So we want that independence. We want more of the expertise of South Africans to come to the party. I'll give you another example very quickly as I close. There was a lovely initiative in Johannesburg, the pointsman point system,
right?
They started private sector. I'm not going to mention their name now. It's free advertising. But there's a particular insurance company that started this move to say this condition on the road. Let's hire some people, create some jobs. We point, we put them there, and they can alleviate traffic congestion.
Sure.
Brilliant, brilliant plan. Mm. And they assisted and they stepped in. That is a competency, of course, of government by way of JMPD in Johannesburg. But they were able as the private sector to help. Okay, there were some squirmishes along the line, but they seem to have resolved the issue now with the city of Joburg. But it's a beautiful way where we're seeing synergy, public-private partnerships. That's what we need to leverage off of. And that's what will help the state to deliver on its mandate. And really, when people believe in a government that works, they'll be able to give of their own resources, their own time to make things work. So that's why we are very much pro independent people coming to work with the government and the state. And we are very much pro an independent speaker, because we don't want anyone who is biased in any way, not in favor of us, but also not biased against us. Somebody who's going to help keep law and order and not, you know, bring in rules that are prejudiced towards or against anybody.
Let's change gears. You talk about jobs. Do you, and this is Bosa, think that job creation is a responsibility of government or of the private sector?
Both.
Oh.
So the role of government is to create an enabling environment.
All right.
An environment that is conducive towards the flourishing of businesses, be it small, medium, or large.
Yeah.
Let's take the township economy, for example. We're saying to people in the township, guys, innovate, start businesses, go out there, create jobs, do all these things. How are they going to do that with no electricity?
Mm.
How are they going to do that with no running water? How are they going to do that with no water reticulation plants that are able to make sure that sewage is taken care of? How are they going to do that when there's no refuse removal? How are they going to do that if you don't give them the space or the factories at affordable rates for them to do? So we are just saying lip service and you go and create jobs.
Mm.
So as a government, you're supposed to create an environment where if someone says, I want to start a business, they're not fighting against, you know, generator costs and inverters and also not having to find a way to get water because there's no water. That person can just go in there with an idea. They're able to get funding and they can leverage off of what government is doing. And this is the same also for larger companies that come to the country. I mean, we're hearing rumors of divestment and this one is removing their plant from South Africa, etc. because the government is not able to create an environment that enables them to flourish. Yeah. We know that when it comes to our transportation sector, for example, our ports, and when it comes to the issues that we're seeing at Transnet, which business is going to say, oh, let me use South Africa as an entrance into the African continent when we have Mozambique or we have different areas along the shoreline, Namibia, etc., yeah. whose ports are now showing us flames, you know? And so it's important for us to see government as an enabler. They're supposed to create that capable state that, again, the president speaks about a lot, but we're not seeing it, right? Yeah. A capable state is a state that is able to say we have enough doctors, they are hired. Yeah. We have enough nurses. We have enough of what we need, critical services that will be able to support any business that starts here. Then we look at the private sector. And they ought not to also get a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah.
Because they also have a responsibility towards this country since their profits are derived from this country. And this is over and above your CSI or CSR project where you give that 1%, etc. No. This is making sure that the people who work for you, your staff that works for you, are being given the correct remuneration that is just and equitable. Right. And you're not skirting and running around so that you're not paying people. This is also making sure that you're not trying to take whatever profits that you have made in the country offshore to different stock exchanges, etc. So it's important because job creation must come from both the private sector, but must be enabled also by the public sector.
It's 2 weeks after the voting, after the 29th of May, the chief electoral officer announces, and you, Bosa, announces the ruling party, the party that won. What would Bosa do in their first 100 days in office to enable the economy to create jobs in the first 100 days, particularly for the youth?
I'm glad you said it's 2 weeks later because it means the first day scream and shout and high five and do a kwasa kwasa, that day is over. The important thing that we feel is the number one priority and the glue that holds all other socioeconomic development together is job creation.
Yeah.
That is our belief. And that is why at the launch of our manifesto, we said we're launching a jobs plan. And this is a plan to get a job in every home. Mm. There are homes where there is no adult who is working.
Yeah.
They are dependent on social grants. And we know that social grants are important because they bring relief. They are able to be a stopgap measure. And they are a solution to many, many people who are desperately looking for assistance. Yeah. But we also know that they can create a dependency syndrome when there are no jobs to assist people. So if we are then saying we want this economy to grow, the solution is jobs. We will make sure that within the first 100 days, we are working with your private sector to create factories. We need to make sure that a made in Katlehong, made in Soweto, made in Dantsane is not something that's a figment of our imagination, but it is real.
Mm.
Then when we speak about that, we don't only just want what people call the township economy, where people are able to trade among themselves right. in the townships. We want an economy from the township, where you're able to take whatever goods, services that you produce there externally, outside to your different provinces, but also outside the country, where you're making sure that we are exporting goods that are made here.
Yeah.
We believe in beneficiation. We believe that the minerals that are produced here in this country do not have to be just shipped overseas. Yeah. We can make sure that the cars are built here. We can make sure that the minerals are processed at the site here. That is a number one priority that we have here. And then we also believe that we have to look at things like import substitution, where we're not just importing absolutely everything, but we're able to ask and say, what can we make from here? As well, that we can make sure finds residence and is bought. Where is our car? That is a South African car.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. We're seeing that our people in the clothing and textile sector are doing the most. There's Drip, there's Batu. Those ones I can give them free airtime. I don't mind. You know, yeah. We have that. There's Tepo jeans, etc. Where are the other more bigger in industrial factories that are producing your vehicles, your TVs, etc.? That's what we need as well. And that's what we would be working towards. And again, leveraging off of what the private sector has already done, where we say, help us make our own things over here. We're seeing entrepreneurs who have made electric vehicles, electric two-wheelers. I think there was a gentleman who did that. These are the kind of people where we say, you're already doing the work. We as government are going to work alongside you so you can make your factories here and you don't have to import some of the parts that you use for this vehicle. So definitely that's what we want to do. Make sure. And then make sure that young people are also capacitated. Mm. We're not just going to say, go to school and then good luck.
Yeah.
When you're finished with matric, we want a year of service for all young people, compulsory. Mm. This is where you teach them about job preparedness, job readiness. Yeah. This is where you give them that added advantage that they may not have received in high school prior to them going to tertiary or your TVET colleges, if not university, or some of them will then say, we want to start something. This year of service is going to make sure that they are not only employable, because it's important if we're saying we're providing jobs for them, but they can also become employers.
Yes.
And that's what we would be busying ourselves with when it comes to creating jobs.
How would you then, taking you back to your industrialization strategy, how you're thinking about firms and, you know, creating our very own cars, for example, how would you maneuver the high labor costs in South Africa? Because South Africa has one of the highest labor costs. In fact, we've seen a sudden stop in investment coming in South Africa. In fact, they would prefer to go to your China, which strived with the institutions or with systems like the SEZ, Special Economic Zones. And Mauritius also had their own fair share where they grew their textile industry enormously, creating jobs, in fact, taking their unemployment to about 3% in 1993. You coming in, there's a labor union presence in their firms. How are you going to maneuver that to ensure that you still attract investment?
Hmm. I think where the private sector complains about labor costs, it's because the pie is not big enough and the profits are not what they used to be or what they can be. Then they complain about not being able to pay the labor. But where you have a situation where the profits are of the extent that enables them to absorb whatever they're paying in terms of your labor costs, then the issues are minuscule. So what we would want to do, like your SEZ, you're right, your special economic zones, when they work, they work really well.
Yeah.
You're able to say, we put you in this area over here. We make sure that we provide the electricity that you need. We make sure that we support your business as much as we possibly can, so that when you are paying for the labor costs, you're not feeling it in your pockets because you're not having to deal with generator costs or you're not having to deal with fuel costs, because labor issues become an aggravating factor or a burden. It becomes incremental to everything else.
Yeah.
So if you then say to the business, we create an environment that is enabling for you to flourish, that business will be able to say, we are able to absorb this labor. We are able to make sure that people get decent wages, because we also see that we ourselves as an organization or a company are growing. And we also see that government is offsetting some of the costs by putting us in these zones and enabling us to be able to reach our objectives and our targets. And it is important for us to be mindful that people must be paid well.
Mm.
Cost of living in South Africa is way too high. Mm. We cannot say to people, oh no, you know, there's cheap labor in China, so just be strong, take the peanuts that you are given here in South Africa, because it's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not fair. We know what happened in Marikana, where people were fighting for a measly 12,500 rand. Mm. So it becomes so important for us as government, as I said, to create an enabling environment for business to be able to reach the profits that they need to reach, knowing that they factored in the labor costs there. And I believe that when people know that we are, you know, optimizing our profitability, and government is meeting us halfway in terms of making sure that there are tax incentives when they need to be incentives. There's a buffer when it comes to energy, etc. We're able to pay the cost that we need to pay for labor.
Yeah, and I think you speak of a very important factor, which is you know, the contribution of business in terms of just increasing the labor intensity, but I think I'm more practical, and I speak for business, and I speak for young people who want to start businesses. You know, you speak to some of the guys that are heading up the Startup Act, and they'll tell you that labor is one of the stumbling blocks for, you know, having businesses that go in this country. So how do we maneuver that? Because obviously it's not easy in this country to hire somebody, keep on paying them, because you are calling for more higher wages, you know, for people to be compensated even more. It's not easy in this country to hire someone.
You want people to be compensated fairly.
Fairly.
Mm. Fairly. Yes.
Equitably.
Equitably,
yeah. Yes. But it's not easy in this country to do that because of the high labor costs. As a person who started a business, you know, it's not easy to hire somebody. It's not easy to keep on paying that person. It's not easy also to retrench that person if the business does not do well. Mm. And that's a stumbling block for a lot of businesses and a lot of people to come into this country and start businesses. That's a model that the Silicon Valley, for example, has used. So you say, let us make it easy to bring people on board. As we start businesses, let us grow the businesses as high as we can, and if the business fails, well, I'm sorry, you know, we can let you go. But in this country, it's not easy to do that. How do you maneuver past that?
And I think that's why it's so interesting for me. It comes back to that question of why we don't want deputy ministers and why we don't want so many ministries. We have an entire ministry that is dedicated towards small business, and yet we are finding ourselves grappling with that. There has to be a clear distinction between the rules that you have set for your multinationals and your conglomerates that have reserves, as it were, and can give out retrenchment packages, etc., should things go wrong, and a startup that is in a township or a rural area or even a peri-urban area, whatever the case may be. We have to be able to make differentiation to say, you are starting out, you are entering into this level. Here are the requirements that you have in terms of labor. Here are your requirements in terms of tax, etc. So that you can create an environment that enables this particular organization to grow. But we also have to make sure that there is stringent measures to make sure that this person doesn't take advantage of the system, because they can also turn around and say, I'm still a startup 10 years down the line. So that speaks to monitoring and evaluation as well. But where it works well, it would work brilliantly to have people on the ground able to inspect, here's this business, what sort of assistance do you need, are you still growing, are you coming up, let's see your books, etc. And where you can make a case for, we are still in ideation phase, or we're still just, you know, doing a feasibility study, so I need to hire people to assist me in that regard, then you're able to be supported even in terms of the labor laws. But that goes towards a government that is able to create an environment that is conducive. Conducive environment is not just about infrastructure, it's not about the provision of water and electricity and those related services, but it is also in terms of policy, not only just the creation or formulation of policy, but the implementation, and more importantly, the monitoring and evaluation of the efficacy of that policy. So you're quite right. You know, it's the same as when people say, I want to get into property, maybe a back room kind of situation where I want to rent the rooms out, etc. And the laws at the moment, rightfully so, because they want to protect people from homelessness. They will say, if you want to evict somebody, you have to go to court, you have to do this. But at the same time, you are paying the bond. You as an individual who has bought this property or is trying to create legacy for yourself, you have paid for the bond. So we have to be able to say, how do we meet both of the expectations? Somebody needs a roof over their head, but this person has started this venture of trying to create legacy for their kids, so they've bought either back rooms or a flat, etc. How does a government that is caring create an enabling environment for this person who's trying to create wealth for their family, and also this one who is trying to receive shelter, to the point where it does not punish this one who is now trying to create legacy and is paying for a good year sometimes when that person is not paying you rent, when are you paying the bond for the full year, because you cannot evict them without a court order, and the court order, we know, has got a hectic backlog in terms of what the courts are able to do. So it's up to government to create those policies that protect entrepreneurs so that they can be able to create the jobs, but also able to create wealth for themselves and their families. But we also protect those who are looking for jobs and those who are looking for shelter in the case of the accommodation story.
Before we go to a break, just quickly, I mean, I say quickly, understanding that this is a very huge crisis currently facing South Africa. This is, I mean, everyone is tired of load shedding, right? Everyone's sitting here. We sort of normalized it to try to live with it. And when it's stage two,
at least, you know.
Yeah. So how are you, as BOSA, coming into power, going to resolve this in a few practical steps?
We believe in the energy mix. We believe it's important for us to not just rely on coal. We know that a number of our power stations are old and they are shutting down, and that we need to start looking at more creative ways in which we can generate power. We don't want to do away completely with coal, especially if we do still have reserves. But we are looking at your micro nuclear plants. We definitely want to look at that micro small scale. We also want to look at other renewable energies, wind, solar. We have ample space, for example, in countries, provinces, although sometimes when you're traveling there, it does feel like a country. Provinces like the Northern Cape, vast, vast land mass, you know, small in terms of population, but there's plenty of space there. We have wonderful weather. We have wind. We have sunlight. We have water because we're not landlocked. So those are some of the things that we'll be looking at. A good, healthy energy mix is what we'll be looking into. The issue that we have when it comes to electricity, very quickly, is not so much that there's an electricity problem in South Africa. We have a leadership problem in South Africa. This was something that was forewarned. It was foreseen. We knew that we need to, when you introduce a burgeoning middle class, we knew that when you start to develop, you need to make sure that you are able to supply the power. So for us, we want to hit the ground running. First thing that we do is make sure that you're able to create a system that is able to accommodate this economy of the future that we want to create.
We don't have an energy crisis. We do have a leadership crisis. That is Ayanda Ali joining us in the studio, the communications director for Build One South Africa, that is BUSA. We're going to pay our bills when we return. We're going to continue this conversation. I hope and really hope that you're enjoying it. And if you don't, let us know what we can improve. But this is Ubuntu Radio on the Midday Conversation with myself and Sabine Makubo.
What is Africa? Is it the wildlife, the beautiful coasts, thriving cities? It is more than that. It is the people. Our 55 countries have many things in common. Our cultures bind us together. They give us strength and identity. They make us proud. By sharing our knowledge and working together, we are building a new Africa that's driven by investments, by game-changing infrastructure projects, and using transformative technology to change the way we live, work, and conduct business. Using our largest natural resource, our vast arable land, we are making advances in agriculture, developing new industries, creating jobs, and improving livelihoods. Together, we are moving forward on economic integration. By consolidating Africa's significant internal market to foster trade within the continent and with the world, Africa is open for business. We are building the Africa we want. So, what is the continent of the future? The answer is Africa.
Welcome back, and thank you so much for staying with us until this hour. We've been having a conversation, very interesting conversation, with the communications director of Build One South Africa, that is Miss Ayanda Ali, in the studio with us, dissecting quite a number of issues, taking it from their politics, what's their political makeup, diving into how they promising to create jobs, looking at how in the first 100 days in office, come the day they're in power, what are they promising us? And Ayanda did tell us exactly that. If you missed that part of the conversation, we will be sharing the podcast. You can catch up with that later on. But again, thank you so much for staying with us. We continue this conversation with Ayanda, of course, with us here. Ayanda, a noise, some would say it's a cliche, some would say it's a quite important element into the entire economics of South Africa. If not politics, the land. What is BUSA's take to the question of the land? Are you somehow, you know, what would you do to address it? Because everyone is talking the land, and it looks like it's now a palatable campaign ticket.
We believe that restitution is important.
Sure.
We believe that land is crucial, not only just, you know, in terms of having space to stay or live or, you know, making sure that you have shelter. But we know that land is important. It speaks to dignity. It speaks to heritage. It speaks to history. It speaks to a place of belonging. But we can take it a step further and speak about the produce that we receive from land and how one is able to sustain their family. And so we think it's important that we have this conversation. We are of the view that restitution can take place in an amicable way and in a just way and in an equitable way, because we need to have conversations about how we do it in a manner that still is able to safeguard the productivity of the land. It's important for us to have conversations about from who we take the land and to who we give the land. And when we speak about land tenure reform, when does it begin and where does it end? And when it comes to me as an individual who owns land, do I then, in my personal capacity, want to cede that land to the state so that the state owns all the land? And how would I then want to lease it, etc.? So we are of the view that the land question is absolutely important, and it must take into consideration the past and where we're from, and it must also include the kind of future that we want to create. If I can digress very quickly, but still stay on topic. A couple of years ago, we did something in my professional capacity called AgriTeen. And with AgriTeen, we were empowering young people with an understanding of the land that they live in,
yeah,
of farming, of the value chain, and all the many things that they can derive from it. And it showed me that the vast majority of young people in this country don't understand the complete picture or the ecosystem as it pertains to land, which then makes me wonder, if we are speaking so adamantly and aggressively about land, to whom will we give this land if we are not preparing the people we say must then have the land for the conversations about what to do with the land?
Yeah.
Right? So we're not in schools giving them some sort of information or enculturation that values the land, etc. That's why we're seeing when many people are given the title deed back, or maybe even as a group, and they're given the land rights back, they then have to scurry and find what do we do, etc. That's why we see many of the projects that were there become dilapidated, they are falling apart, they're no longer productive, etc., because you thrust this upon people, rightfully so, you know, it belonged to their forefathers, etc., but then they're not able to maintain and upkeep. And I'm saying there has to be a parallel between the conversation we're having about land and making sure that we're able to bring about a sense of justice, and that conversation going hand in hand with empowering people for the land. I cannot buy my son a car and not prepare this person for driving the car, not getting him or her a license. If it's a son, it's definitely a he. Yeah. Not getting him a license, not getting him any training, not helping him get his learners, not helping him learn how to drive, etc. But I say, I've bought you a car.
Yeah.
And so the land debate, and when we speak about restitution, when we speak about bringing about justice there and making sure that we're finding an amicable way to really deal with the land question, we also have to speak about how then are we preparing the recipients of the land and those who will then receive the land back. And I think that's a critical discussion, and that's why we're seeing many people when offered, you know, the choice between do you want the land back or do you want the money, you know, they take the money.
Yeah.
They take the money.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they'll say, do you want a place to live? Just, I give you a case now. Go online, this is a homework I'm giving everybody. Go online, look at your various property online platforms. I won't mention them, no free advertising for them. Go away and look up your RTP houses. Look up your RTP houses. Bramfisherville, Kagiso. Go and see there. Tsepisong. There are so many of them for sale. So many for sale. And so you realize that people have been given this land, people have been given houses, etc. But what good is that RTP house if I don't have the means to sustain it? They just gave me an empty hall There's no job. I don't know what I'm going to feed my kids, etc. And so people, I mean, have not been capacitated to the extent where we say, all right, now you have the RDP house. Let's do veggie gardens here. Mm. Let's show you how you can earn an income here. Let's help you with the back rooms, whatever the case may be, so you can generate money. So for me, the important part is, yes, we definitely believe the land question must be put on the table. We have to find an equitable way that we bring about justice in the sector, but equally, don't just thrust it on people without grooming, empowering, and developing not only mindsets but also capacity financially and otherwise for them to make the most of this land or home or property that you will give them.
So, well, do you have more questions for
Anna? Sure. I think just on a governance focused part of the conversation, I saw that you proposed to raise the pass rate to 50%. I think it's unfortunate we're running out of time, but a lot of your manifesto is focused on reforming the education sector.
Absolutely.
And I saw that you proposed to increase the pass rate to 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Just take us through that very quickly, because I mean, from my side, as like I told you, I'm a practical person. Mm-hmm. You know, we had 41% people of the 2023 matriculants pass with a bachelor's. You put that together with those who passed with a diploma, it's about 20%, I think. It's about 60% of the people who are above 50%.
Yeah.
Take us through why you want to raise it to 50% if we already have about 60% people above that rate.
Because you get what you ask for. Mm. I think if you then create a concept that says for you to make it home scot-free is 30%. That is the aim. That is the target. And even if you then are going into your studies as a youngster, but also as a teacher, if you put your targets there, you know, at least I know by 30% these people will make it. It speaks to the kind of energy you put behind your lesson plans. It speaks to the kind of extracurricular activity that you will try to do to try and scaffold the classroom experience. It speaks to the kind of resources that you will plow into that particular lesson, because you know, if they can just get 30%, then that's all I need to make it.
Yeah.
We're saying that children deserve better. They deserve a higher percentage in terms of the pass mark, because that is then what we'll work towards. If we're saying it's 50%, that's the benchmark, then people will put the kind of effort required to reach that 50%. Right now, we're not seeing that in mass. And when we get to varsity, this is why within the first year, we have so many dropout levels when people go to tertiary institutions, because they are not used to that level of stringent requirements in terms of the pass mark. And we know that because of what we allow in terms of your education system to say 30% will suffice, then they are already inculcating this view that solanka, as long as, at least. And we're saying that children deserve better, and they can achieve that 50%, and the teachers are able to, and we are so passionate about teachers and teaching that we're even saying we want to pay teachers more. We want to make sure that they get paid more, because all of us are a product of a teacher.
Yes.
You know, all of us are where we are because there has been somebody who took the time to teach us something. Mm. But the environment in which they teach and how burdensome it is, classrooms overcrowded, you know, them having to do so many things, insufficient groundsmen, they are in an environment where they are also holding on to, hey, let's just give them the 30%, because if we have to do the 50% without these resources, it's asking for too much. And they are right. And that's why we're saying we can't just say increase to 50% and not increase the ability to teach, or not give them also classrooms where teaching and learning is something that happens with ease, you know, where they can have assistance where they need assistance, smaller classes and the kind of technology that they need, and where there's partnership that is required between a school, for example, that is in a rural area or even maybe a township, if they need to partner with a school in suburbia so that they can cross-pollinate ideas and also share resources, then that's what we need. But we're also saying we want your private sector to invest in schools in townships, and we want to empower parents to be able to have money where we'll give them a voucher to say invest in the local school that you want your child to go to. And that's why you will find then parents able to take a child to a school within a 5-kilometer radius and not be concerned about the quality education, instead of what we're seeing now where children are packing unroadworthy vehicles. Every day there's a mass exodus out of your townships to your suburbs because parents want their kids to have better education. Kids are cramped in there. Sometimes horrific accidents happen there, and that is because parents are just longing for better education for their children. So we're saying, if we then say pass mark 50%, we empower the teacher, we improve the classroom experience that is there, we empower the parent to be able to invest in that particular school and the school governing body to improve it, we eliminate so many problems and we improve the quality of education. But more importantly, it becomes more level, where a school in Soweto will have the same classroom experience as a school in Sandton.
Ayanda, after all said and done, in 60 seconds, why should you, or why should everyone, I, Mbekezele, Makhubo, Kuhle, why should they vote for Busa in 60 seconds?
South Africa still lives in a time where we have two realities. There's the land of the haves and the land of the have-nots. And we know that even the middle class is struggling to put food on the table and make ends meet. We need to come together and build one South Africa. Hate is not the solution. Division is not the solution. Finger pointing and the blame game is not going to get us anywhere. We need to leverage off of the collective ability of each South African in different spheres of society and make sure that we work together to build the South Africa that we need. It is only through Build One South Africa that you can elect your leader directly to represent you in parliament. It is only through Build One South Africa that you will be able to see yourself represented in the leadership. Gone are the days where you're going to be represented by somebody who has no idea what the cost of bread is. You will be represented by somebody who is close to the issues and somebody who cares. So build one South Africa for a job in every home.
That's the timer for Ayanda. Well done. Thank you so much, Ayanda. David doing that very nicely in 60 seconds, giving you a reason why you should vote for Busa. Thank you so much for being with us. We highly appreciate it. We highly appreciate your presence. We can't wait to see you doing good, grow personally, well as in your capacity within Busa, including the party itself. It has been a pleasure for us to be with you here.
Thank you.
You said you're representing Soweto.
I'm representing Soweto for the
time
being.
Are you, by any chance, from Lofaya?
I love Lofaya, which is right next door.
Yeah?
Right next door to Lofaya.
Now, this
I
is,
love the song as well.
Thank you. This is Spikiri. From Soweto as well. Maybe you should come to Busa and say the fire.
You must do the right thing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless you. Thank you.
Well, God bless you too.